This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Economic and Business History Channel. I am Paula de la Cruz Fernandez, and I'm your host today. I'm a historian of gender and business, and I'm also a host and editor in the New Books Network in Español, which I encourage you to listen to. Today, we are meeting Dr. Lydia Pine. Welcome, Dr. Pine.
It's wonderful to be here.
Dr. Pine is a writer and historian interested in the history of science and material culture. Her writing has appeared in The Atlantic, Nautilus, Slate, History Today, Hyperallergic, and Time, as well as Archaeology. She is currently a visiting researcher at the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. In 2019, she published Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Can Teach Us About the Real World with Bloomsbury. And today we're talking about her most recent book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network, published with Reaction in 2021. I want to start the interview by asking you to tell us a bit more about yourself and your professional career. What made you become a historian?
I knew that going into graduate school, I was interested in history, in archaeology, in sort of big questions of material culture, how humans use things, how we think about things, how we think about objects, and those sorts of things. And so the books that I write and the questions that I'm interested in pursuing in these books, I think tend to circle around these questions of humans and how we think about stuff. A previous book that was sort of a precursor to Postcards was Bookshelf, which is a cultural and object history of bookshelves that was published by Bloomsbury in 2016. And a lot of the resources and things that I ended up exploring for Postcards were inspired by this bookshelf project that I had done previously.
Wonderful. What inspired you to write Postcards? Why Postcards?
Why Postcards? Yeah. So there are a couple of different, it's such a great question. And there are a couple of different threads that I became really interested in exploring. And so, like I said, in 2015, I was working on the research and writing of Bookshelf. And I found myself at the New York Public Library, looking at the history of industrial institutional bookshelves and doing some behind the scenes tours of their bookshelves. And while I was there, I happened to come across, it was completely sort of by accident, it was serendipitous, I came across their collection of postcards. And it is this amazing, amazing room. It's a room full of card catalogs that are just collections of postcards. And I started looking through these postcards and just sort of thumbing through them. And it was such a, it was such a transformative moment to think about all of these messages that are being sent and received. And here they are sort of all collapsed into this amazing collection of postcards in card catalogs. And it felt like I was almost reading text messages or messages in bottles from 100 years ago. And I was so intrigued by the idea of these kinds of short communications that were saved and we could read as part of the record of material culture. So I sort of filed away the idea that I would be really interested in exploring a object history or material culture kind of history of postcards later on. And then in 2019, 2020, I was able to pursue this project with Reaction. I would say the other thread that was really inspiring to me about the book were the family history and personal postcards that sort of came out of the woodwork. So when I started talking to my extended family about, oh, I'm working on this project about postcards, wow, people had saved a lot of postcards. And so people would just send me these boxes of postcards. And on one hand, it was super overwhelming because now I have all of the boxes of postcards. What do I do with them? But on the other hand, it was amazing to see just how incredibly varied postcards could be. I had family postcards that had been sent from Mexico in the 1890s. There were postcards that had been sent in Europe in the mid 20th century. There were postcards that were, you know, from California, and it really just in looking through the giant scope of how these objects looked, I felt like inspired me to pursue the project, pursue postcards in a way that was not, that could be bigger than just, here's the history of one particular printer, or here's the history of one particular style of art on postcards. I think that there are a lot of postcard histories that do that, and they're incredibly valuable and interesting to be able to do this deep dive through one really specific thread of postcards. But sort of having these two experiences of having extended family sending me postcards, recirculating the postcards, if you will, and then having the New York Public Library collections, it felt like it helped me shape the interest in looking at postcards as a giant class of artifacts.
So interesting. I wonder if there is an archive for Twitter messages or iMessages. Like, how are we going to study these messages in the future?
Right. The messages that I was reading, you know, my great grandfather's postcards, it's like, oh, I'm coming by train on Friday, or, right, you know, thinking of like, they're, it felt like, it filled the same sort of linguistic niche that text messages or iMessages do today, or that tweets or Instagram posts or all of the different social networks that we use. It felt like you could sort of trace them through these old postcard lines, sort of network by network.
So your book starts with a period in the history of postcards that you labeled postcard craze, and it is connected to this moment in the U.S. post office's history when the institution survived a severe financial crisis in the early 20th century. Could you tell us a bit more about this period and how postcards became postcards?
Sure. So the story of the U.S. Postal Service sort of being saved by postcards was pieced together by a historian, Daniel Giffords, who documents that in his work with postcards. And when I came across his work and I came across the story, I was so struck by this kind of way that postcards are able to leverage this giant institution out of its financial misery, and being able to sort of turn a profit 2 years later. By 2011, or excuse me, by 1911, postcards are really sort of helping the U.S. Postal Service run in the black for the first time, like, in forever. I felt like a really formative episode that I was able to come across, because it helped me think about the scale of postcards. And that's been one of the things that I really wanted to connect with readers and audiences about postcards, is the sheer scale of what this communication medium was about. And I felt like the story of the U.S. Postal Service being saved by postcards, I felt like was such a great example of the sheer mass and scope that postcards had at the beginning of the 20th century. And so sort of around that framing, I had the opportunity to dive into all of the different social and political infrastructures that facilitate sending cards. So, you know, everything from stamps to printing to the postal service actually delivering postcards. I was able to trace different historical threads with those.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, perhaps the history of the printing ink to the printing press and, you know, kind of that life cycle of postcards?
That was one of my favorite things, honestly, to dive into was the history of ink and paper and how ink and paper come together in this really sort of social way. So one of the examples that I dove into for this was the story of the Kurt Tekin Company, which makes some really classic Americana kinds of postcards. And it was fascinating to learn about how ink adheres to paper in different sorts of ways and what are innovations that are necessary in ink chemistry and ink technology. And the same with paper that sort of facilitate ink being able to stick onto postcards. And sort of with that, it prompted me to think about the questions of what is print and how do we think about print and how are postcards part of this print, this tradition and this history of print. So in talking with historians of print, they were able to sort of help point me toward the idea that print is social. And from there, it was really fun to dive into the questions of postcards being participatory media. And that's one of the things that I really was excited to take away from this project and to think about was the idea that people have to participate in postcards, whether it's buying them, whether it's sending them, whether it's writing the messages, that fundamentally I came to think about postcards as this participatory print media.
Right. And it is also part of the history of industrialization. So what is the country that could be perhaps pointed to as the kind of the origins of postcards printing?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those really funny questions. It's a great question, and it's a question that everyone has, but it's sort of like, well, what is the first postcard? And I think trying to pin down the first of things gets really, it feels like it should be so straightforward, and it ends up being kind of tricky. Yeah, exactly. So a couple of contenders here. There is Theodore Hook in 1840, who comes up with a postcard in England. It's sent as a bit of a joke. So that's sort of one of the contenders for a first postcard. However, Dr. Emanuel Hermann of Vienna in the 1860s is sort of considered more of the inventor and the sort of origin point for postcards being sent continuously through the mail. And in 1869, the Austrian Postal Department issues regulations about what can go on a postcard. And so we really sort of, by the late 19th century, we see postcards absolutely taking off. But again, you sort of think about, well, this idea of participatory media or filling in the blank or things like that. one of the things that was really fun to trace with that was to look at the history of printed indulgences and to look at how indulgences, when they were printed, would have this blank space to be filled in. And again, it was really fun to dive into these questions of where does the idea of filling in the blank come with media? And so, yeah, we have these examples of early postcards from 1840 or 1860s, but I think the precedence for that can be traced back hundreds of years prior.
So let's go to the shipping part. Well, you know, I'm very interested now that you're talking about the message about, because there's not so much a space to write in a postcard. Who decided the right size of postcards?
Well, there are a series it's such a fun question. So there are a series of regulations that are developed in the last century and a half, almost 200 years, of what can go where on the postcard. And so the original postcards did not have printed pictures on them, that they were just simply, they would be more akin to like index cards today. And so the idea that there's this divided space on the back. There's a picture, then there's a divided space. Maybe there are some printed lines for the address to go on. These are actually rather recent developments in the history of postcards. But the really fun part about this is that the message is semi-public. It's not sealed in the same way that like a letter sort of has this imbued sense of privacy. But the postcard in some ways is a really sort of performative kind of object to send, because anyone who finds it can read it. And so in the initial days of postcards, there are examples of some European governments that are very strict about what kinds of messages can go on postcards, what can be censored, what's appropriate, what's too racy or too saucy to put on a postcard. So it's not just the images that are sort of open for public consumption or public censorship. It's also the messages that are going on the back.
Right. So in terms of shipping, I was super curious about the global aspect of postcards. And that's one way, you talk about it, is how, where did these messages go and where did they come from? But also in terms of organizing to ship that, like there has to be a place, there has to be an address, right, where to send that postcard.
So, yeah. I'm trying to think. There are a couple of different ways to sort of dive into the question. So there are definitely a couple of interesting tracks to follow with the development and formalization of addresses. So, for example, some of the family postcards that I was looking at, it just says, send to Robert Bowles, Guthrie, Indiana. And that's enough to get great-grandfather Robert his postcard. Whereas there are other addresses that are, sort of as we urbanize and as we get closer toward the 21st century, we see addresses become more specific and more formal with that. But in terms of sort of shipping postcards around and shipping them here and there, I think that for me personally, one of the most interesting aspects that have come out of that was to think about them in terms of imperial or colonial lines and looking at what images and postcards are being sent where and how under the auspices of colonial empire and tourism, and who is sending what where with that.
Yeah, I do. I did enjoy very much that section about how, this idea of power and the way imaginaries, right, are created. Imaginaries about the other are created through postcards. Can you talk about the images and what creates the other through postcards?
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of really interesting themes in terms of art history or in terms of colonial gaze or things like that that are sort of going into the idea of what ought to go on a postcard. And I think it plays into also the idea of sort of the exoticism of tourism at the beginning of the 20th century and sort of the idea of, oh, I went to this place and here is what I as a, as a tourist expect to find. And so the postcard is going to, I think, pander to not only the sender's preconceptions, but also going to, I think, play into the recipient's expectations as well, where it's sort of like, oh, look, this really is how other people live. Or look, it's sort of like the postcard becomes a bit of photojournalism and not sort of a bit of propaganda or colonial propaganda in and of itself. And so I think that there's a real blurring of that in the beginning of the 20th century. And some of the examples that that came up were really interesting to think about in terms of whether permissions were given for putting images on pictures, where the images were being printed, where images were coming and going from. But as you say, there's a lot about colonial power to unpack that goes along with postcards.
Yeah, I think actually most of the images that you saw are of women, right? And of women doing traditional, perhaps labor in these countries, that no longer exist or in these countries that are now part of our market, right? With especially in the Middle East, for example. And that makes me go to the next question about corporations and businesses using postcards as a way to advertise them. So, for example, you use Kodak, right? And I would love for, if you can talk a little bit more about it. But actually, I mean, postcards were. What is the difference between trade cards and postcards? Now that I think about it, because I've done research on Singer, and Singer had this. These trade cards, which is different, right? But I wonder if they could also be used as postcards. And they also did lots of postcards in different countries. So can you tell us about postcards and advertising?
Sure. And I think that that's one of the most interesting and implicit parts about postcards is they are advertising, right? The picture is advertising a connection, whether it's real or imaginary, between people and place, between sender and recipient. And I think that Kodak is able to really capitalize on that in the early 20th century. And I think that one of the big strengths with the Kodak postcards is that they're able to sort of put the image creation in the hands of the photographer. So rather than having corporations or companies that are printing, like the Kurt Tekin Company, Americana postcards, rather than having these companies print images en masse, the same image en masse, a Kodak camera allows a person to take a picture and then to have that picture printed on a postcard, that it actually is, a photograph printed on this postcard cardstock. And it, I think, is interesting because it democratizes the postcard image production, but I also think that it begins to walk this really interesting line again of the sort of nascent days of photojournalism, and particularly at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of areas of conflict, whether it's the Mexican Revolution or World War I, a lot of times they were called real picture or real photo postcards. A lot of times, these postcards, these real picture or real photo postcards are doing a lot of social work in conveying this is how it really is. And I think that that sort of realness of the picture becomes a double-edged sword.
Other images in postcards are, for example, international events, and you talk about the Mexican Revolution being one. I guess you talk about postcards being one way to inform the public about different events going on internationally. How can you say, for example, how the Mexican Revolution was portrayed in these postcards?
Yeah, these were fascinating postcards to dive into. And so the postcards that I came across and that I used to think about this particular section and sort of the themes of propaganda, how are postcards, real picture postcards, used to create propaganda? It became fairly clear fairly quickly that in the case of the Mexican Revolution, the photographers, the American photographers who are taking the pictures and producing these postcards, are doing it really to pander to very jingoistic or very, very sort of American national expectations. They are not flattering. They're not particularly, I'm trying to think of the word, appropriate. So a lot of them I was very uncomfortable reproducing in the book. I felt like that a lot of the postcards would show hanged bodies or executions, or they were really, really quite horrific. And so it was interesting to see the sort of whiplash that occurs between here is a postcard that's of executed of executed people versus here's this postcard that's sort of a bright, cheery, touristy kind of image. And to look at, again, to sort of going back to the point that we were talking about at the beginning, to realize that postcards as a medium can cover that entire gambit of experience and communication. But I think in general, the experience of looking at the Mexican Revolution postcards and realizing which postcards had been manipulated or changed sort of in their printing process, and looking at the research that historians have done with that, it made me feel a little bit more skeptical maybe about some of the images that are produced. And it made me appreciate how much or how easy it is to give real picture postcards kind of a pass and to say, oh yeah, it's a picture. This is real. This is how something happens. But to realize again that it's framed, it's a curated kind of image.
What's the percentage of political or like international affairs images as opposed to perhaps touristy images or
oh my
less
goodness.
I guess less political, right?
Oh my goodness, it's such a good question, and I'm a little hesitant to try and venture I guess about it. I guess the best sort of factoid that I could offer with that would be that historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, something like 200 billion postcards were in global circulation. And so I think I sort of come back to humans have made 200 billion postcards. That's a lot of different images to put on them. And so I think that I would just sort of, rather than try and venture a guess about what percentage is political versus what percentage is this, you know, sort of floofy tourist, whatever, I think I would just leave it at, I think I have seen pictures of just about everything on the postcard.
Right. So let's go back a little bit in that process, in that life cycle of the postcard, and let's focus on the companies, manufacturers of postcards. Who curates or decides, who is the editorial board that says this image goes in, this image doesn't, in this companies?
And so in the example of the Kurt Tieck postcards, there are some really interesting archival images that I came across that sort of walked me through how a postcard was made. And so it starts with a photographer and ends sort of with an editor. And it doesn't seem to be a particularly involved process. It doesn't seem to sort of have a committee of, oh, here's all of the, you know, here we're going to sit down and we're going to vote on which postcards. But there does seem to emerge an aesthetic for different companies. So the Tuck and Sons postcards are going to have a sort of particular kind of image that is associated with them. The Kurt Tieck postcards are going to have a certain kind of image that's associated with them. They almost become their own genres. I would say in sort of a more sort of art history kind of way. And so I think that what becomes, I think more than sort of who is deciding other than the photographer or the sort of person or the people that are in that sort of image processing process, I think that it becomes sort of how does the evolving aesthetic of these different companies sort of solidify and give people what they've come to expect from those postcards.
I'm going to ask you later what was your favorite postcard. But
oh no, that's like asking me a favorite kid or something.
I know, but I will. My favorite one was actually about where the series. You can also answer that a series of ones, mm-hmm. But the women suffrage movement one.
Really
love them.
Yeah.
So can you talk about how did you approach these ones?
Right. So the women's suffrage postcards were really, really fun to dive into. And I ended up pairing those with the other propaganda ones that we've talked about, that I wanted to explore the theme of how postcards are part of publicity and propaganda. And so everything from, you know, global conflict to the women's suffrage movement. And so with the suffrage movement, again, sort of we see all styles and genres and kinds of postcards that go with the suffrage movement, everything from color printed images of sort of artwork to, you know, sort of get out the sort of 100 year ago, get out the vote kind of propaganda, to real picture images that are, you know, sort of showing, look, here's this rally, here's this parade, here are people, you know, trying to raise awareness of the women's suffrage movement, or trying to show how this is how I'm participating in that. What was particularly interesting to me about the women's suffrage postcards was the point that the idea that buying a set of these postcards was considered participating in the movement. Like, oh, here I'm buying these postcards. I'm participating in the women's suffrage movement. And it became a way of sort of demonstrating from a consumer standpoint that, hey, I'm sort of buying this, but I'm buying into this movement as well. And that was a really interesting, that really sort of changed my thinking, I think, about that. I'll also point out that for as many women's suffrage postcards there are equally as many anti-suffrage postcards. And so the propaganda for that goes both ways. That again, they can be the sort of horrific cartoons, or they can be whatever sort of anti-suffrage position somebody wants to put on a postcard. I can pretty much guarantee that it's been on that postcard. So again, it was a really sort of useful way for me to think about what does it mean for propaganda to be able to exist en masse? And the media for this, the postcard, is just the media, and the message is sort of specific to different groups.
So, okay, so which one was your favorite postcard? And also, which one was maybe the message that made you laugh the most, or the message that made you cry? I don't know, something that was very, surprising while you researched postcards.
Yeah, it's I like your point, though, about that postcards have this sort of personal, emotional kind of connection, that they pique these connections. I think the one that I had to laugh the most about is one that I included in the introduction, where it's a postcard that says, "Hey, we missed you at Sunday school." And it's like this printed postcard that's sent to someone to shame them for not going to church on Sunday. And it just made me laugh that it's just, you know, "We hope to see you next week." And I just found that incredibly, incredibly funny. I think the most poignant postcard that I came across was a set of embroidered postcards from World War I that my great-grandfather brought back from France. And the postcards are that there's sort of a three-dimensionality and textile, there's a textileness to them. And that was really fascinating to see, and then to see how they had been saved for over 100 years in the family. Those I felt like were really fascinating postcards.
Yes, they might. I have not seen an embroidered postcard, so I would love to see that. In relation to that, about the kind of afterlife of postcards, because the same thing with Christmas cards and things like that, I have a hard time saving this. I do have, you know, and I'm a historian. I have a box with, yep, you know, that I say, this is my archive.
Yep.
And so I save things that I know I'm going to want to look at them, you know, afterwards. And I want to kind of have to show, you know, people in the future that, yes, this is how we did this and how we did that. But there are so many. You cannot save all, right? So tell us about your research projects and how, you know, besides, you know, what other, besides your personal postcards and the New York Public Library, you know, how can we access postcards now, and how people save them and institutions and so forth?
Yeah. And so there really is a sort of interesting split, I think, in how people have saved old postcards. And so one is institutionally, like we were talking about with the New York Public Library. Fascinatingly, patrons can actually go check out postcards the same way you check out a book. And some of the librarians were telling me that design students or art history students, for example, will check out the postcards to be able to work with projects and things like that. other big libraries like the Newberry Library in Chicago have a massive collection of the Kurt Tieck postcards. And there's also been a mass movement to put a lot of these digital collections online. So the New York Public Library, in addition to its several rooms with postcards, with physical cards, it has an amazing online collection. The same with Welcome Images in the UK and other sorts of institutions. There's a real push to sort of put these postcards online. And I think that the interesting split between the physical card and the image online is for some of the online images, institutions will only put the front of the card, the picture, which is I think sort of it lets us get at the art history or the sort of image questions of the postcard, but I feel like we end up missing a lot of the the message that goes with that. And so in my own research for the book, I ended up using a collection or both types of postcards, digital scans as well as physical collections. And then I finally had to tell my extended family that I was done with the project and nobody needed to send me any more boxes, shoe boxes full of postcards that were good. But what was really sort of interesting and poignant about it, though, is a lot of older relatives had said, oh, I saved them because I knew that somebody would want them someday. Or I knew that I'm so glad that they're going to a project. And so there was a real sense that they were going to be important. And so I saved them. And then there was a lot of, I think, sort of gleeful cheer that it became somebody else's thing to store.
Right.
But
did you donate them to an
institution? No, afterwards? No, okay. They're still on my shelves in these shoe boxes. Because the same logic is, oh, I can't get rid of them. They're important. These are family history. And so, I just need to get another set of shoe boxes, I think.
Yeah. Awesome. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate your time. And I wanted to end the conversation by asking you, what's your current project?
Oh, my current project. So I am currently wrapping up a short book project about Endlings, E-N-D-L-I-N-G-S. And it is the last known individual of a species. So it's a very different kind of project than postcards. But I think that if I were to sort of pick the thread that postcards will continue for future work, I think that it would be through the questions of ink or pigments or things like that. That was a really interesting thing to dive into.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for connecting with me today.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for your time. It's been so much fun to chat.
And thank you everyone for listening. This is the New Books Network, the Economic and Business History Channel, and your host, Paula de la Cruz Fernandez.